Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Erwin De Vries in this episode. Erwin is adjunct faculty with the School of Education at Thompson Rivers University and associate faculty with the School of Education and Technology at Royal Roads University. Following an extensive and award-winning career with Thompson Rivers University's Open Learning Division, I interviewed Erwin via Skype. Well, it's my privilege to talk to Dr. Erwin De Vries. Throughout his career, he's worked in the book publishing industry. He's worked for the British Columbian Open Learning Institute, the University of British Columbia, the Justice Institute of British Columbia, the Certified Management Accountants of British Columbia, and of course, Thompson Rivers University's Open Learning Division, which this year celebrated its 40th anniversary. Erwin's a recent award winner for excellence in open education and co-editor of the International Journal of E-Learning and Distance Education. Erwin, great to be talking with you.
Mark, thank you very much. I'm really glad to be able to talk. Well, yes, you're asking a little bit about my background and where my interests derive from. Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a mechanic. I loved playing with things. I loved taking things apart. I was a lot worse at putting them back together than I was at taking them apart. My grandfather, now long gone, but he used to tell me the story about when he bought me some kind of a wind-up bunny or something as a kid. You wind it up and it would move around. And I was much less interested in the fact that you could wind it up and watch it move around than I was in the fact that there was something inside there that made it do that. And so to his great chagrin, I tore it apart and pulled this little wind-up mechanism out. And that was the part that really interested me. So I don't know, maybe my interests go back to some childhood curiosities, but I do think curiosity is the core of our endeavors. And I think when we talk about learning, if we haven't tapped into curiosity, into sort of that deep desire to know, to understand, you know, we're turning into something that's a little more mechanistic. So it's not just the product, it's what's inside it and what's making everything tick. In my early work, one of my first jobs was at the Open Learning Institute back in the early 80s, and this was a new organization in the province of BC in Canada, intended to kind of modernize higher education in the province based on the model of the Open University in the UK. So there were such things as disaggregation of course production and course delivery, but more the routinization. And so I had a role in that as a course developer, and I developed a number of courses ranging from heavy duty mechanics to nursing, to business management, and so forth. So that was my early experience in being involved in distance education. But what was really interesting was that everywhere you went, there were these signs that said, think student. The idea was to think much more about the student in their situation, in their context. That was a revolution in my own thinking at that time, because I'd gone through my own earlier education and experienced learning very much as something you go to, it's done to you, you do what they ask you, and when it's done, you get your ticket.
Yeah.
And so this was a very different model, and we spent a lot of time thinking about how do we get learning to the learner who otherwise wouldn't be able to access this. So that was an early philosophy, I think, that really influenced my work. Before that, I was an editor, a book editor with Prentice Hall, where we edited textbooks and took them to production and worked with graphic artists and illustrators and writers and editors and video specialists as well. And so this modality of education and learning depended a lot more on the integration of a number of different media technologies. And that's what was really captured me, was the depth and the breadth of the kinds of skills and the talents and the creativity and the art that we could bring to this particular modality of learning and education.
So you obviously did some quite innovative things then, sort of spurred on by that background.
Well, yes, it triggered a new kind of thinking, but also at the same time, it became a model that, in a sense, I think became somewhat involved in standardizing the production of courses. So there were course teams. There was a certain, almost like a production line. When you scale this up, it becomes a large machine-like way of doing things. You lose that, and we lost some of that artisanal touch that you had with individual faculty members. We were still in the early 80s, so we were using video conferencing and broadcast television, like the Knowledge Network, a little bit of community radio, and then, of course, mostly print, and then whatever objects you might want to include, ranging from early computers to rocks for a geology course and stuff like that. But yeah. It was still a fairly standardized production process, whereas there were other faculty around in my own province who were doing all these little one-offs, particularly as the internet expanded. They started playing around with web delivery of courses. I know one faculty member who had a web server under their desk and a little 286 or whatever IBM computer into their own personal web server, which would go down if they accidentally kicked the plug. So there was another stream of, I think, innovation, which was much more artisanal. Of course, institutionally, these were difficult to sustain because in the meantime, students would call because the service is down. You know, the course would be there one time and the instructor would move on and the course was dead. So it became more absorbed into the IT infrastructures of institutions and kind of spawned that whole new industry of IT and educational technologies within the universities.
So how did you reconcile these two concepts of the industrialized production, which of course is Otto Peters and classic distance education, but also these signs saying think student? There must have been a little bit of a tension there at times.
There was, and I think remains, a tension. I think online learning and the broader concept of distance education is kind of splintered somewhat into different directions. We still have an abundance of open universities, more than I think most people realize around the world, although they're mostly in the developing world, Asia and so on. And what's happening in universities in terms of developing online education as a new way of marketing to a new audience, a new demographic of the older learner, the working learner, and so on. And each one of those has its own particular goals and desired outcomes. But that sort of craft of developing courses in one-off is still, I think, under a certain amount of pressure because we have learning management systems. It's got to tie into the student information systems, grading. People just want to be able to upload their marks easily. People want to extract data. We want more and more data about our learners. We want it for marketing. And so I don't think that pressure is reconciled at all. And I know that we all have this little inner child inside of us screaming to break out and come back to that. But we can't go back. We have to keep moving forward in terms of what's around us and what our capacities are.
Can you give us a brief overview of your publications as well, the things you've been publishing over the last few years and perhaps your involvement with the journal?
I mean, I'm not an extensive scholar in the sense of research and publishing a great deal. I've done a lot of presentations internationally. My work is largely in practice. However, I do occasionally publish something. So recently, I was working on a publication with Martin Weller, Katie Jordan, and Vivian Rolfe. And this came out of a discussion we had several years ago at a conference where we were all kind of rueing the loss of some of the early thinking around distance education and open learning and what these things meant, because a lot of what we read and hear sort of in the discourses around openness in education don't seem to be deeply rooted in earlier understandings and practices of what openness is. And for those of us who are involved in open education for longer years, starting from the early days of open education and schooling, you know, with people like Illich and Barth, the whole distance education, the Open University emerged in the UK. You mentioned Peters, and there's Holmberg and Rumble and so on, who had a lot of interesting observations to make about what the distance learner is and what those pedagogical aspects are of learning at a distance and learning in a different location from the traditional learner. And then there was that growth of e-learning and online education, which kind of now started to fold more technology into our learning and more technology at the personal level rather than sort of that broadcast method, which was used earlier, television, radio, and so on. We pulled that together. Katie, in particular, did a wonderful piece of research of citation network analysis. So we kind of delineated those different themes and how they interwove and put them on a timeline as well. I'd mentioned open education in schools, which has been in discussion for a long, long time. Sort of that open learning movement, e-learning, the use of technologies, computer-based training and learning and so on, technology-enhanced learning. There's different languages for it. And then, of course, open access publishing emerged, open educational resources with the OER, the UNESCO thing. So there's a whole history that I think has been arising and that we want to keep track of, so we don't let open start to compress into more narrow definitions. Yeah. Just yesterday, I was in a in a session with some of a faculty session with some of my colleagues at Rhodes University. We were just exploring the word open in terms of our practice as we're trying to use more open tools in our education courses. And we're continually dazzled by the complexity of that concept and how many questions it raises. And so we're only at the early front end of thinking about what all of this really means. But we should never forget our history. So we need to. So that's, I think, something that I found particularly interesting. I find that interesting professionally. And I can also link that back to some of the experiences that I was just describing about my early days in open learning at the Open Learning Institute, where already those kinds of pressures between sort of the formalization and industrialization of learning versus the personal craft of teaching, how those interact and interface and how we can continue to enable those with how, surrendering to this big machine of online learning and even more, maybe in some ways terrifying, the machinery of learning going forward. And I think start to safely use words like the Googleization of learning or the Amazonization. We're getting early glimpses into the possibility of institutions that may start using Amazon and their cloud tools. The cloud suddenly is emerging as this great salvation for us. Yeah. And somehow there's this cloud. There's an interesting evangelical concept to the idea of the cloud, that somehow that there's all these wonderful solutions available to us when we reach into the cloud, that somehow that we aren't able to produce ourselves anymore, or that can do what we do better. By means of vast, artificial intelligence and algorithms that will know us better than ourselves and so on. And I think what we really need to start thinking about now is to what extent is this superstructure helping us to learn versus to what extent are we tools in the learning of that superstructure. I think by understanding our history, we can go back to understanding, the project of learning and the project of education and why it needs to remain a human endeavor out of an ethic of we care for our students, we care for our colleagues, we have this enterprise where we want to improve the lives of others, improve the lives of society, transform our society, transform ourselves. And so that pressure between being those individuals and teams and colleagues who are engaged in that against being cogs in a almost like an ambient teaching machine. I don't know if anybody's using ambient learning. One thing we've heard recently, I think we were all a little bit shocked to find that one university is looking at pairing up with Amazon and using Amazon Echo as a way of communicating. We have a right to become a little bit frightened by all of these. So we need to consistently stay connected with our roots.
Some interesting themes you picked up on there. So there is, of course, some moral foundations to what we do. You've also highlighted again the tension of the industrialized and almost cookie-cutter way in which pedagogy can sometimes appear in distance education, online education. You've also touched on the great heritage that distance education actually has. It's come up previously, actually, with interviewees that there's a rich heritage to all of this that we'd do very well to re-engage with.
Yes, and so I think we need to be very reflective practitioners. And my own background is largely in instructional design and learning technologies. And I kind of have a fear for that field because instructional design is quite central as a bridge between the teaching, the collegial body of teaching, the academic world, and the world of technology and technique and method. And instructional designers kind of live at that intersection. And I think Audrey Waters has really hammered this more than anybody I can think of, and I'm very grateful to her for the work that she's done in pointing out the deep behavioral roots built into many of the technologies that are now being served up to us and sold to us by Silicon Valley entrepreneurs that are, in a sense, continuing to use systems of rewards and little punishments and little pellets. I call them pellets, like gerbil pellets, that you use to train animals or rats or rodents, little pellets of likes. I mean, the like has become one of the most powerful motivators right now. It's right up there with caffeine. Every time you get a like, it's a little affirmation, kind of builds us up. So these drugs are being used to help influence how we learn. Of course, all that information is being taken back and used in different methods to market back to us in this emerging capitalist system of technology enhanced education. So instructional design, I think, in general, and I include myself, I'm not pointing fingers, I'm pointing that to me too, I think we're trapped to a large extent in a behavioral or behavioristic model of learning, still being quite committed to the idea of very clearly defined learning outcomes using behavioral definitions. Still, we're swamped with the tools, you know, with different, you know, Bloom's taxonomy and building learning alignments around behavioral outcomes. And of course, that fits in with a larger picture of school accreditations. And, you know, we operate in a bigger world.
Yeah, we do indeed. Can pick up on the theme of open education for a while, because it's obviously where a lot of your history and publication has been. And of course, you've got a long-standing association with the OERU as well. So can you tell us about some of the ideas and themes that your work on open education has provided, particularly those that you think are still relevant today?
Well, first of all, open education, we can't get too lost from the notion that openness and education are focused on access to learning and breaking down barriers to learning. So I think there's, first of all, access within the superstructures of learning, like the institutions of education, being guarded megaliths versus going to the learner and being where they are, sort of that open learning idea, but also in the infrastructures of learning, that we're breaking down barriers of discipline, narrowly focused content areas. So we're opening it more to the learning that they've already had in their own lives, their own understandings, opening up to more contextualization of learning rather than just seeing that learning is something that's delivered. It's something that we contextualize, that we apply in our own lives, that we, you know, and then we share back in different ways with other and continue to evolve and grow. So it's sort of that depackaging of learning, sort of more in the infrastructure of the way we do things. And I think that kind of connects back to with what I was saying about instructional design, where as long as we're sort of using highly predefined learning outcomes within the way we do things, we're closing off the openness of that particular learning opportunity to the learner, because they're working towards the exact thing that we've defined for them rather than creating opportunities for them to look more generally at this learning experience as a resource that they can both individually and collaboratively use to deepen their skills, their understanding, to help with their transformation of knowledge and to think through how they can apply through that knowledge in different ways. So I think openness, you know, we talk a lot about open education resources and open educational practices, and these are all part of that infrastructure of education. But I think I still want to also keep that focus on how we view learning, I think, in a more intimate sense, in terms of how we design that learner, instructor environment, learning environment space.
Let me pick up on that. So obviously the term open can be used in quite open ways. And you're saying here that open education should also include some form of open curriculum.
Yes, I think that's a fair way to put it, because we're awash in curriculum, and at least our formal learning designs are in so many ways so already pre-structured for us. And definitely, you know, I mean, David Wiley talks about OER-enabled learning, you know, opening up the resources in a way that they can be reused, re-edited, repurposed, and so on. There's a whole open pedagogy built into that. You know, as long as we're working within a curricular infrastructure, or maybe I should say superstructure, that asks us to stay within the boxes, there's only so much we can do with that. And then we lose the potential for the kinds of creativity, you know, that I was talking about earlier, the artisanal nature of learning and the fun and the joy that we can have with technology as makers rather than consumers, as producers rather than viewers. So I think openness is a mindset that there are all these pieces to it, but it also has to be a mindset and a personal philosophy of how we want to enable our learners and our peers to explore and create, open up and flourish in their lives and in their thinking.
It's really interesting you said that openness is a philosophy more so, well, perhaps than a set of practices.
In the end, I think probably yes. I mean, is it a first philosophy? Probably not. I think the first philosophy has to run deeper, because openness in itself, if we apply that a virtue to that, we then also, I think, blind ourselves to the danger of openness. And there is a time to be open, and there is a time to be not open. There is a time to protect, and there is a time to expose. obviously we're seeing that in our early days of educational technology, a lot of the versions of working in the open web and kind of rooted the idea that we can't get out there in the open, you know, that our LMSs and so on limit our work on the open web. But with the corruption of social media that I think we've begun to see and are becoming increasingly aware of, as well as the way that the openness of the web and social media and so on can be manipulated against us, has to give us a whole new set of cautions. Yeah. So openness in itself, I don't think we can just see that as a prime virtue. I think we have to go back to more of a sense of social responsibility and protection, and then back to that philosophy that I've talked about of care. Like we first of all have to make sure that our students are safe and that we're doing the right thing at the right time. Just saying everything's open, you know, get it out there. And I think we need these conversations. We need to continue to sort of probe what it really means for us and remain connected to the core ethic of what it means to be an educator, rather than thinking instrumentally about I think there's way too much research that just focuses on the instrumentality of learning technologies and the technologies of teaching techniques and so on. And is this one a little more effective than that one? Or do students like this one a little better than that one? These are things we need to know. These are tools of the craft. I do think of teaching as a craft. So these are tools of the craft, and we need to continue to polish those techniques and those tools. But we also need to continue to ask deeper questions about what fundamentally it is that we're trying to do and why we're doing it, and you know what those outcomes, what we're seeing as those outcomes in terms of our learners and their lives.
Brilliant. That sort of leads into the next question, actually. So it's now late November 2018. So what are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? What are some of the key things we should be thinking about? You have touched on some, but are there any others that spring to mind?
Okay, well, first of all, online learning is becoming ubiquitous. You mentioned Tony Bates earlier. You know, he's been heading up a national survey in Canada, probably going into the third year, if I recall correctly. We're clearly seeing that it's growing very rapidly in Canada. It's becoming mainstreamed within higher education in my own country. And I think I'm certain in many other areas around the world. Yeah. I think universities have discovered that demographic of, you know, it used to be called returning learners or lifelong learners. I think we need to find different language for that. The fact that we do have a large body of learners beyond those who just come out of school. In fact, the people that come out of school, a lot of them want to go work for a while because it's so expensive to go to school. Mm. So there's not that phenomenon of, you know, you finish high school and you go to university and you live happily ever after. People are constantly going back for graduate degrees or adult degree completion or certifications or gaining professional designations. Yeah. This is a commonplace. And so online learning is working towards meeting that need. But are there other ways to do that as well, too? I don't know to what extent we've thought that one through, but just sitting down at a computer and working through course content, are there better ways? That I don't know, but I think we want to start exploring how we can better support learning in a more situated way. You know, our learners aren't just in online spaces. Probably maybe 20 years ago or so, there was an interesting growth of the idea of situated learning, workplace learning, and to what extent can we help support learning in those spaces? Those are some questions I would find really interesting without relegating it to machines or just-in-time learning. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. Right now, I'm working with several colleagues here in BC as well as in collaboration with BC Campus. We'd like to start thinking about developing an open textbook or probably more of an open reader on the whole area of, I'll call it instructional design for ... But how are we designing for learning in our day-to-day world? How are we designing for learning in virtual reality? I just looked at some applications at a demonstration. They were dismal. There's absolutely no learning design whatsoever in them. So how are we going to design learning in other ways than just putting courses online? How can we expand our tool set? How can we be an influence rather than just a reluctant participant in this massive growth of Silicon Valley style technology, quote unquote, innovation?
It sounds like the sort of research you'd like to see, and you're also participating in it as well.
Well, right. And I do think we need to start researching, but there is that interaction between research and practice. I think we need to be experimenting. We need to be, I actually do think we need to engage more, you know, rather than just being completely critical. And we do need critical mindsets. And there's wonderful critical work being done in critical instructional design. You know, Sean Michael Morris, you know, there's some people out there who are thinking very sharply about these kinds of questions. But then we also need to be taking these ideas and engaging with, you know, maybe even engaging with industry. Why aren't we having these discussions and trying to help shape some of these technologies as they emerge and maybe at some point supplant our online learning methodologies or certainly enhance them? Because right now, I think we're just kind of standoffish and saying, that's terrible. We need to leave it alone. And I agree, it is terrible. I just put on an AR device and it made me sick, and it hurt me because it was pushing my glasses into my face. And the demo people didn't seem to care. And I would say, this thing hurts me. They say, yeah, but look, you know, do this and do that. And I thought, I have a body. You're not even properly fitting this thing to my body right now. And while I was playing with this device, another one of the representatives had to hold, you know, a few fingers on my shoulder just to keep me from falling. So I think rather than leaving the future to electronic engineers and investors and pseudo-educational experts, I think we want to start exploring this more intensively in our own institutions. And we need to do this collaboratively. We can't just do this on our own. I think we need to start thinking about partnerships and collaborations. And I know these things are happening, but these are some of the things I'd like to see in addition to sort of that growth of online learning. I mean, I think the growth of online learning is great. I'm happy to see it. I've been part of it for most of my career, and I think it's meeting a lot more needs. My own students, when I look at them, I see myself, you know, 20 years ago, and I see how they're weaving this learning in. They're going for their master's degrees, and they're professionals in higher education as well as in industry and in NGOs and so on. And I see how they're taking this, fitting this learning into their life and using these tools to come up with some profound learning. I mean, I see some wonderful, exciting things happening in their lives, but they're asking questions back to their peers and to me in our courses about the technologies that they're running into in their own industry. One works in policing and says, you know, we keep getting this VR stuff pushed at us and I don't know what to do with it. Another one was in the medical system and the health region, and the same kinds of things were there. So I guess one of my concerns is that working online learning, we could start to fall behind where our students are progressing towards in their own professional practice. So we need to keep to be able to provide as educators rather than just that instrumental view of how to make it more effective. We need to be thinking about how can it enrich and humanize their learning and their workplace and their service and so on. So we still need to be thinking about how does that ethic of education translate into our way of developing and continuing to grow and evolve our practice.
That's great. Erwin, you've obviously benefited from others' input and others' ideas across the years. Are there two people you'd recommend as leaders and legends of online learning? Perhaps someone whose work or perspectives has significantly influenced you, and perhaps one you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share?
Well, someone that I really appreciate more in the practice field is David Porter from eCampus Ontario. And he's worked very extensively with the whole field of educational practice and collaborations, working with government as well as with universities. And he was one of the early ones promoting collaboration among institutions to better grow our partnerships, thinking together, trying to get the universities and colleges thinking beyond just working individually and how we can better collaborate. So I think he's a very, very creative and innovative thinker. Whose work is really influencing? I have to say, Sean Michael Morris from the University of Mary Washington. He's one of the individuals that has really sparked my thinking in terms of critical pedagogies and critical instructional design. And he came from more of a, I think, commercial instructional design background. And then he came into the university field and he said, I had all this behavioral training on behavioral learning outcomes. All of a sudden, I'm dealing with this university setting where we want more open-end exploration. He said, and I never felt equipped to do that kind of transformation, to teach in this new way. So he started thinking through himself and writing about this. He's more of a blogger. He recently just co-authored a book sort of in that area on critical pedagogies that I think is fascinating. I think we need to listen more to him.
It's been wonderful talking with you. You certainly are a leader and legend of online learning, particularly in the open education space. It's been a real delight talking with you.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciated the opportunity to do this. I'm very honored to be part of this, so thank you so much.
You can find Erwin's profile and links to his research from our website. His Twitter handle is ErwinDev. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.